Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 17 of Season 8 of Movie Run Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg classic Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Simon Appleton of the Movie Mustache. Hello. Welcome back to the show, Simon.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Yeah. We were going to dive right in. We got a lot more going on here. And so minute 17 begins with Mike questioning Ryben and ends with brains being splattered all over the place. So, I mean, this is an interesting minute. This is a minute that has always really surprised me every time I see this movie. But, you know, we finished yesterday with Hargrove screaming to Ryben, and we're not sure what he wants. And this minute begins with him saying, "Where's your BAR?" Now, do you know what a BAR is?
Browning Automatic Rifle.
That is correct. So it's a light machine gun, but it's a heavy machine gun, basically. You know, it's much more powerful than the regular machine guns that most of the other soldiers are using here. Most of them are just using M1s and things like that. So, you know, this basically, I guess you have a guy in every platoon that, or one or two guys that have these heavier weapons. Do you know when a BAR was when it was first designed? You know, like how far back do you think it goes?
I want to say 1917.
You are perfectly correct. And the funny thing is the official number of this is M1918, so it's 1918, which is very interesting. It was designed by John Browning in 1917. They were using it during World War I, and it was a replacement for they were using French-made machine guns at the time. And the idea was is that this is a weapon that infantrymen can use during an assault. You know, they have a sling over their shoulder and it can be shot basically from the hip. And, the concept of attacking this way was known as walking fire. You know, the idea was, is that during trench warfare, during World War I, they thought that was the most important thing that you need to be able to be on the move and still shoot at the same time, you know, without having to need, I guess, to put it up to your eye to check the sights and things like that.
So get your enemies to keep their head down while you're advancing, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So they would have right before World War II, they started introducing models with bipods on them. You know, two pieces of metal that will make it that you can, you know, put it up on something to shoot, to hold it while it's shooting.
Stable shooting platform.
Yeah, exactly. And, they started reusing it right before World War II in 1938. And it was being used as a portable light machine gun. And, during World War II in Korea, it was used quite often. And it was used a little bit in Vietnam, but basically was phased out at that point, and they started using other weapons during the Vietnam War for that whole thing. So basically, at this point, you know, Ryben is given the, you know, is being asked where's his BAR. You know, you're the guy in charge of the BAR. Where is it? And Ryben responds, "Bottom of the channel, sir. The bitch tried to drown me."
And I love that line.
It's a great line. And Hargrove doesn't even think for a second before responding, "Find a replacement."
And going back to what we were saying yesterday about the gather weapons and ammo, that is a pretty standard order on the face of it. But the implications of it are quite different.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you also have to take into consideration the fact that, think about it, that if they already told everyone to go gather weapons and ammo, you know, even just a few seconds ago, Ryben didn't do it. What does it say about Ryben? You know, he's there without a weapon. Obviously, you can't blame a guy for being very scared in that type of situation. But until he's given the order that he has to go find a replacement, he doesn't do anything about it.
Yeah. And I like it when he says, go find a replacement. He sort of doesn't really look around and think about it. He literally just crawls off in that direction and think, what made you go that way? I mean, Right. Maybe it's just instinctual, but it's just the way he just suddenly just looks up and just crawls off that way. I was like, okay.
Do you think it's because he thinks that maybe he saw someone with a BAR over there? Or is the idea that, maybe I'll just get away from the fire by moving that direction?
I genuinely don't. The look on his face doesn't suggest he thinks about it at all. It's just, or maybe it's just he's come from the other direction. There was nothing over there because obviously you don't know how he got scattered on the beach when he got out of his landing craft.
Right.
So you might just be a case of, oh, I don't think there's one back that way. I'll go over and have a look over this way because maybe he's been looking for one. And maybe there's so many possible scenarios in how he just ended up at the shingle without a weapon. Obviously, he ditched his because he ended up in the water. Maybe I'll go this way. I'll have a look this way, see if there's something that way.
Maybe. But again, the idea that he automatically follows the command.
Yeah.
He doesn't argue with it. He doesn't say, oh, I'll just, and I mean, we're going to find out a little bit later. He shows up, he comes back, within 30 seconds, he's back with a new BAR. But you'd think that someone in his situation, if you go, you're just going to grab whatever weapon you can.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily need to be, a BAR, even though that's the order that he's been given.
Just grab whatever's handy. Like and I know you would have covered this. When they're down by the obstacles, Miller tells I can't remember what they were, but they had typewriters, and he tells them get rid of that crap. And the guy just sees a rifle and just picks it up.
That's right.
Job done.
That's right. The whole thing is just it's surreal the way that they show these things, but it makes sense.
Definitely.
And I like the way that they do it. But I guess it says something about Ryben, the fact that he is going to actually go and find a BAR. Maybe he just feels more comfortable with the BAR, and that's why he went to go get it. I don't know.
Or maybe then, because they've gathered weapons and ammo, that there was one, someone grabbed one, and he just took it.
He got lucky. Well, what it means is that unfortunately there is some unfortunate soul that is not there anymore. And they were able to take his BAR. So I don't know. And I love the way that the shot works, because he then runs or crawls past Miller, and then we go back to Miller basically.
Yeah.
And there's like no even question there. Like the camera follows Ryben until he hits Miller, and then it stops. And then Miller goes, Bangalores, bring up some Bangalores. Now, do you know what a Bangalore is?
Oh, well, the first time I watched this, obviously I was wondering what he was yelling, but they're sort of obstacle clearing. They're obviously some sort of pipe with explosives in them. I don't know the details, but they're obviously designed to clear obstacles and barbed wire and what have you.
Right. So the idea behind them, they're known as a Bangalore torpedo. So it's an explosive charge that's placed within one or several connected tubes. And it's used by combat engineers to clear obstacles that would otherwise require them to approach directly, possibly under fire. So, you have this pole, basically. It's known as, sometimes referred to as a Bangalore mine, a banger, or just simply as a Bangalore, because it's basically a pole charge. We'll see it as they're putting it together. You're putting pole after pole after pole. You're connecting them together in order to get a further distance. And it's a way to basically clear path through different wires and heavy undergrowth and things like that. It was originally devised by a captain of the Royal Engineers in India named Captain R.L. McClintock in 1912. And he invented this idea in order for them to be able to get through like booby traps and different barricades that they had in the Second Boer War and the Russo-Japanese War and things like that. And the idea is that you can explode it over a mine, and you can blow up the mine at the same time. So it I mean, again, we see it here. I mean, have you ever seen The Longest Day?
Yes.
So The Longest Day also shows us the whole idea of using Bangalores and using other types of explosive also, but at least here, we know that's what they're what they're using, in order to be able to get through, get through all of the barbed wire they have there and stuff like that. What's ironic is that when the US Army was using it during the D-Day landings, so the British Army had already stopped using it at that point. They had
Okay.
other things that they were using. So here we have on Omaha Beach, the Americans are using it, but if you go to where were the British from? Sword, I think, right?
Gold or sword.
Gold or Sword, right? So there they probably didn't have these Bangalores. So it's a little ironic, I guess, from that perspective about the whole way that they do this. And then we see a bunch of soldiers running, holding like poles, which obviously now we know what they are. Those are the Bangalores. And someone screams, "Grenades, grenades, get me some grenades, get them over here." And then someone else screams, "Bangalores up the line, Bangalores up the line, heads up, bangers coming your way. Come on, come on, come on." Again, I love the way that there's so much action going on at the same time.
It goes back to what we were saying yesterday about the chaos of it. It's in that way, it's almost like organized chaos. There's so many things going on, and I love the way they shoot it. So as you are put right in there with them, the camera's right up close and personal the entire time. It almost feels like the cameraman probably is, and I think it was Spielberg filming a lot of it himself. He's literally laying in the sand or walking through the sand when you're following the Bangalores up the line. They're right in there with them, and you can feel how that must have been quite uncomfortable trying to crouch as much as you can whilst also carrying these great heavy pipes.
Right. That's true also. And but here we hear people talking about grenades, and people are talking about the Bangalores, and you have these guys running with the Bangalores, and then like the shot they give us a nice long shot of it, of these guys running among the various soldiers, looking for the place where they need to connect the various Bangalores and stuff like that. And we see Mike starting to put them together. And we what I love seeing here is that Miller is completely in control. At the beginning of this movie, we saw his hand shaking as he's on the boat. But here he's in the middle of battle and his hands are not shaking.
But it's like they say, it's not just in any scenario where you're about to be tested or you're trying even interviews, it's beforehand where the nerves are the worst, where it'll make you falter. Once you're in it, you're so focused on the task, you're not worrying about it. It's quite an oddity of the human mind. It's the waiting, it's the build up to it that you've got to get through. Once you're doing it, it's actually better because you're focused.
Correct.
I th think they again that's what they really show in Miller
Yeah,
throughout.
for sure. For sure. When he's in the middle of battle, he's fine. When he's not in battle, he's shaking. And at this point, we see Mike trying to, put together the Bangalores and moving them. And then as that's happening, we have a guy run up towards them and say, "Jackson here, sir." And then, then we get someone else. Then we have Ryben back, and he goes, "Ryben back, sir." And then Ryben does something really strange. Did you see what he did?
It loads his BAR.
Yeah, but how does he load his BAR? He takes
Takes a.
the cartridge and bangs it against his helmet before putting it in. Now,
Is he.
do you think that that's for practical reasons, or do you think that's superstitious?
I'm It's either that he's, I don't know, getting the sand out of the mag, or making the, or it's, it could be, considering, I wanted to talk about this, is it seems that Spielberg liked seeing Ryben reload his BAR, because you see it quite a lot, and he always does it, so it might be a luck thing. I've never considered that. I always thought it was just a practical thing, getting sand out of the mag or what have you. I know it's in a pouch, but sand gets everywhere. That's why I hate the beach.
But, understandable, especially if you're running with the magazine and you need to put it in the, you know, in the gun.
Yeah. So now that you mention it, it could be a superstition thing, because this is something you've seen. I've seen in other war movies. But I don't know. I don't have the knowledge to say whether it would.
Okay. Well, let's put it this way: the answer is both. Okay. Right. People think that it's practical. There are people who say that it works, and people say that it doesn't work. The idea basically being that if you supposedly if you tap your magazine against a metal helmet, so it makes sure that everything is properly in place, so that it won't jam. Because if all the bullets are lined up one after the other the way that they should be, then it's not going to, you know, to jam up. Again, that can still happen also, but it's going to lessen the chances for that to happen. There are other people who say that it's completely useless and it doesn't really mean that it's going to be doing anything. There are other people that say that it's, like you said, to get rid of, maybe sand or dust or anything like that might be there. But there's also the superstitious aspect of it. And, you know, the idea being, if I tap it against, my helmet, then that's going to, you know, make sure that everything goes right. You know, that type of thing. So I did a little bit of a search to try and find if there are like other superstitions that people in the military, try to abide by, I guess you can say. Can you think of any? Do you know of any? Or do you? I found a list of five.
I grew up in a military town, but I'm not aware of superstitions of military.
Okay, so one of them is that you should never carry a white lighter.
Okay.
A lighter that has the color white. And the reason is because it has to do with the 27 Club, which is the club that is made up of famous musicians and artists, you know, like Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, all these people that died at the age of 27. And most of them, if not all of them, were carrying some sort of white lighter. So the idea is that, in the army, there was a amphibious assault vehicle that lost its brakes and it went off a 100-foot cliff. And one of the Marines on it was carrying a white lighter. And so basically they said, okay, you know, they said that the fact that he had a white lighter there, was able to disrupt the balance, and that's what made them fall off the cliff. Again, it sounds like complete BS, but I just find it very interesting. They say that if you're on a boat in the ocean, a military boat, you should not whistle, because they say apparently the god Neptune hates whistling. And if someone whistles, they're going to, he's going to drown your boat. There's another one about apricots. There are places in, they had an article in Stars and Stripes in 1968 about in Vietnam, that apparently in a number of different areas, after someone would open a can of apricots, to eat, they would start getting like missile barrages around them. So they basically started saying that, okay, we're not going to be doing that.
No more tins of apricots. Got it.
Apparently not. Yes. then there's the idea of skeleton keys, that apparently if you look closely at the American pattern of camouflage, there are little blotches that look like keys. And apparently there are soldiers who've gotten shot exactly in those spots. So they say, okay, you should stay as far away from having keys as possible, because that could also cause you to get shot with the keys. And the final crazy one that I found here is that you should not use the R word, which is rain. Okay. Usually, you know, when someone just mentions the term rain, so the weather then will change no matter what the weather is. It'll start pouring. And, you know, the idea is you should never use the word rain.
That's like, I don't know if it's the same where you are, but here the cops don't say the Q word. They don't say quiet.
Okay.
If it's a shift that's not a lot going on, they'll say, oh, it's very Q, because if you say the word quiet, inevitably something will instantly kick off.
Okay, then there is something about that. It makes sense. Right, and then there's another one that I knew about that I came across when I was doing the research here. Have you ever seen the movie The Best Years of Our Lives?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so there's a certain point towards the beginning of the movie where you have these three guys on a plane, and you know they all are lighting up cigarettes, and one of them says, "Are you guys superstitious?" And the other two go, "No." And he says, "Well, I am," and he puts out the match and takes out the third match. So the idea of three on a match.
Okay.
Which is also known as unlucky third light or third on a match. And it's a superstition among soldiers that the idea is that you don't light three cigarettes for soldiers on the same match. Because if you do, then one of them will definitely be killed. And usually it's the third one who was on that same match. So basically, after that, people in Western culture decided to start, you know, taking that on as a regular superstition, not just in the army, about the fact that you don't have three people lighting their cigarettes from the same match. But I think it more comes from the idea that you know, if you're in a hazardous area and you have a match lit for so long, you're going to maybe give away your position, and that's why you possibly get shot. You know, I think that sounds like it's more realistic.
Yeah. Yeah, but, no, definitely.
Exactly. And then, you know, after Ryben does this, we once again start hearing huge screams from, like, really loud screams from a soldier screaming, "Oh, my God!"
Yeah.
And then, you know, Miller is still overseeing the whole idea of the Bangalores. And he says, one more. Give me one more. And then they give us an extended shot of hearing more screams. But what I love about what they do here is we see Jackson's eyes.
Yeah.
And Jackson looks freaked out by the fact. Mm. I mean, this is a guy who through the rest of the movie, you know, he's you know, very brave, and everything that he does is, you know, borderline dangerous and stuff like that. But here you see that he's for once also scared. So it means it doesn't matter who you are. You can get scared in this type of situation. You know, and his eyes just say so much. I mean, yeah. Barry Pepper does a great job in this movie. And, you know, this particular scene I just love from that perspective.
Yeah, yeah, I've actually written something about this because I was looking at it and thinking, yeah, he's listening to that and he's trying to block it out of his mind. And he's probably – it's because it's like what I was saying about how before you do something is the worst time. It's when you're actually doing it, you're all right. It's the same sort of thing. He's got to a point where he's waiting. He's not one of the guys doing the Bangalores. He's waiting to make the next move. So he's probably got going through his mind what he's already seen. He can hear this soldier screaming. He's taking in what's going on right in front of him, and he's trying to focus on what he's got to do and push the fear out of his mind. And you can, it's like you say, you can see through his eyes that his mind is working. And Barry Pepper he's a fantastic actor, and he's particularly fantastic in this. Yeah, so that bit always grabs me whenever I see it.
Yeah. I got to say, I didn't notice it until I was doing the research now. I don't recall ever noticing before, you know, how scared his character is in this particular moment in the movie. But again, it's great.
Yeah, it's like we said, it's they're regular guys. They may have seen combat before, but they're not. This isn't the Hollywood version. These are regular guys in a horrible situation, and he's at that point where he's waiting to do something, which is the worst time. And he does it fantastically.
Yeah, for sure. I love the way that that they do that. And then the shot changes again, and we see that they're still feeding the Bangalores, and soldiers yelling, and then we hear someone scream, "Oh my God, it hurts! I'm gonna die! Oh my God, Jesus! Oh my God!" And at the same time, we see that. Wade is doing his best here to try to pull out like a bullet from the guy's arm or maybe clamp or something like that. Again, lots of blood, very, very graphic the way that they're showing this to us. And, it really just, it takes you out of reality by putting you into this reality. And I just love the way that they do this throughout the movie.
It's, the authenticity of the wound is impressive. The guy screaming does a very good job. I mean, you genuinely feel for him. And it's also Wade has gone from having his moment, and it's only the course of a few seconds if you really think about it. Right. And now he's just back to it, and he's just trying to save this guy by getting a couple. And it's the way he can concentrate on it and also talk to him at the same time. Because he says don't look, and it's really well done, because obviously even as an actor he's not really trying, but he's working all these tools, there's all this blood and fake blood pissing out, he's able to do all of this at the same time. It really sort of just draws you into it. You really lose track of time. We're only talking about over the course of the week, we're talking about 5 minutes of this film, and you every time I've like watched and studied it, you lose track of time.
Yeah,
it's so easy to do. You become so engrossed in it all.
For sure. I just love the way that they do this. And then the shot changes again, and we see Caparzo and a number of other people putting together the Bangalores and letting them go through. And then one of the guys that's helping them out, he gets a bullet hits his helmet and bounces off of it. And Caparzo just looks at him and goes, "Jesus, lucky bastard." And this character who I've not been able to find what his name is. I don't know. You were able to find it. Oh,
he's a British stuntman. Do you want to know why I recognized him? Because I hadn't noticed it was him before when watching it. He's a stuntman who's been in a lot of films. He's the guy in, what is it, Quantum of Solace, that James Bond kicks off of a roof, lands onto a car, and then the bad guy's bodyguard gets out and shoots him. It's like the guy survived falling off a building onto a car, and just for good measure, the bad guy's like, "Oh, he's in my face." So the henchman gets out and shoots him in the chest. He's like a bodyguard in that film for a British politician. But that's why I recognized him, because he's a stuntman who pops up all over the place. And that's the one I specifically remember him from. Like you said, I remembered the moment. I remembered, obviously, him getting hit and taking a round to the helmet and then taking the helmet off and going, "Oh, look at that." And, of course, that being his fatal mistake. But, yeah, I recognized him when I was doing the research for this.
What's his name?
Derek Lee.
Ah, Derek Lee. I thought you said something else. That's why I was looking at someone else, and I was like, that doesn't look like him. Bangalore assistant. Okay, yeah. When you look at his face, you can definitely see that it's him. From IMDb for sure. Okay. All right. So Bangalore assistant, but we don't know the name of the character. No. And then he takes off the helmet to and starts feeling his forehead. And as he's doing that, he just gets shot right between the eyes. I mean, again, it's just unbelievable the way that the graphic, because when you're watching this movie, you're not expecting that to happen. You're basically saying, okay, he was lucky. And he's running his hand through his head, just to make sure he's okay. And then he's going to put it right back.
I was actually I was talking about this film at work the other night, and going, doing my usual and talking about how I'm going to do a podcast on it, and one of my young colleagues made the mistake of mentioning, "Oh, I've never seen that one before." So I actually really, before doing this, I was hoping I was going to get the chance to make him at least watch the opening, so as I could see his reaction to that moment. I haven't managed it yet, but Tyler, don't think you're getting out of this.
Keep working on it. Keep working on it.
Yeah. Oh, I'll get him.
Yeah. And as you know, as we see that he gets hit right between the eyes, that's where the minute ends.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like I said, this is a great minute. I mean, the whole movie is a great movie, but yeah. I like the succinct way that this whole minute moves forward and gives us some great stuff. Did you have anything else you want to talk about in this minute?
The only thing I can think of is, again, going back to the color saturation, in certain shots you get the sort of white haze. It sort of creeps up from the bottom and top of the screen. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder if that's because it's meant to be like a dream or a memory, because obviously we're kind of seeing this as a memory, the way that they film it. Or is it just a sort of indication of something a bit more spiritual and ghostly, because inevitably a lot of these men will be lucky to make it off the beach, let alone survive the war. And I've always wondered that.
I have more of the opinion that it's just to, you know, it's not to make it a dreamlike situation or anything like that. It's more just to say to us, look, you know, this is hell. And, you know, there's so much going on. There's so much chaos and everything like that, that everything is a little distorted. You know, that's the way I look at it. You know, to give us the realism of it. Also, that, you know, if the camera is supposed to be there in a documentary type of way, you know, all the sand is, it's getting sand on it, and, you know, there's all this smoke and everything going on around it, so therefore it's not going to be clear shots. You know, I mean, that's the way I perceive it. But I could be wrong. Sense. I could be wrong.
That does make a lot of sense.
Right. Okay. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Tom Hanks Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five Tom Hanks performances. So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
So number five, I've got Turner and Hooch. It's just a great comedy, and his chemistry with a bull mastiff called Hooch it makes me laugh every time. I love that film. I love dogs, so a film with a dog in it is always going to grab me. Number four, we got Toy Story 2. It's my favorite of the Toy Stories. Even to this, it doesn't matter how many they release, I don't think Toy Story 2 will always be my favorite. Both for Hank's performance as Woody going through a bit of an existential crisis, and also Buzz and the gang trying to get to him. Number three, Castaway. Doesn't matter how many times I watch that film, it always gets me. It's a phenomenal performance. And the fact that he's on his own most of the time acting opposite a volleyball, and he does it so well, the moments where he thinks he's lost Wilson or he gets in an argument with Wilson, they are mind-blowing, because he's literally talking to a volleyball, but this is a guy who's been stuck on an island on his own for 4 years. He feels like the world has forgotten him, or he's been lost, and so this volleyball is his only friend, and I really just connect with it. It's one I'm actually looking to rewatch soon, because I haven't seen it in too long. Where are we? Number two, Philadelphia. One of the films where Hanks showed that as much as he can do funny, he can also do a dramatic role. And seeing what his character goes through, and he portrays it so very well. And there's even he gets to have little comedy moments in there, like when they're putting the makeup on him to try and cover up his lesions. And he says, I want to look like I've been ill, not like I've been on holiday or whatever he says. I really love that. And so he, and even where, later on when things were looking a bit more dire, like the party they have, the he's able to do the sort of, I'm ill, I'm struggling, you know, I'm dealing with all these things, but I still just want to have fun. And he really humanizes this character. And then, strangely enough, number one, Saving Private Ryan. He is phenomenal as Miller. He embodies everything about the guy who has become. He is a great soldier, a great leader, but he's also that thing about how he is back in the world. He's just he's an English teacher. And people look at him and go, "Yep, that figures." he's and everything he's dealing with and going through, and his thoughts on the mission to save Ryan and everything, I get everything that he's saying, and I love the arguments that they have, all the different points of view on saving Ryan, don't save Ryan, and the way he delivers his, there is a bit of malice towards Ryan in there. Right. And his reasons for doing it are his own, but he doesn't turn him into an asshole. He's still a person, and his arguments for what he wants, and Ryan should go off and invent the longer lasting light bulb or what have you. I totally get that. And the way he delivers it and how he feels, and his ability to make it look like his hand is shaking, and it looks real.
That's just great acting to be able to make your hand move like that and make it seem as if it's a real tick, I guess you can say.
Yeah, and it looks genuine, and the way he deals with it, and he's a complicated person, and Hanks puts his full acting talent into that, and the results speak for themselves. So yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, great. Thank you very much for that list. So, Simon, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Simon Appleton?
You can find my blog at moviemustache.com, a random gathering of reviews, news, and generally my opinions on movies. Everything from blockbusters to indie projects. You can also find me on social media, Facebook, Movie Mustache 2.0, because again, Facebook blocked the original page for sharing movie content. Also Twitter, or X, Instagram, and Threads, movie_mustache.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can send me an email at movierobminute@movierob.net. You can find me on Instagram, you can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So, until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this.
In my solitude, you haunt me with reveries of days gone by.